from LPM,
Louisville Public Media.
Support for LPM podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
February is Black History Month, and for many, the 2021 commemoration has a special meaning. Black history was made last year when protesters took to the streets demanding justice following the police killings of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and others. I'm Rick Howlett. Today on In Conversation, we'll talk about Black History Month and how the events of 2020 will shape how Black history is viewed by future generations. Our guests include Roots 101 African American Museum founder Lamont Collins, University of Louisville Pan-African Studies professor Dr. Ricky Jones, and Indiana University professor Dr. Amrita Chakrabarty Myers, who has a forthcoming book about a little-known figure in Kentucky Black history, Julia Chin. We want to hear from you, too. Call us this hour on In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. Welcome to In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. I'm Rick Howlett. Good to have you with us today as we take a deeper look at the celebration of Black History Month. How do you commemorate it? How will future generations view Black history after last year's historic protest in the U.S. and abroad following the deadly police violence against Black people? We're going to have three guests today to discuss all of this and more, and we're going to start this segment with Dr. Amrita Chakrabarty Myers. She is the Ruth N. Halls Associate Professor of History and Gender Studies at Indiana University in Bloomington, and she has a book coming out soon. It's currently titled Remembering Julia, A Tale of Sex, Race, Power, and Place, and it explores the decades-long relationship of Julia Chin, an enslaved woman of color, and Congressman, Senator, and one-term, Vice President Richard Mentor Johnson, a white man. The couple openly lived together in rural Kentucky during the 1810s, 20s, and 30s. Dr. Myers, good to have you with us.
Good morning. Good to be with you. Thank you for having me this morning.
Glad you're here. And later we'll be joined by Dr. Ricky Jones, Chair of Pan-African Studies at the University of Louisville. He's also an opinion columnist at the Courier-Journal and USA Today Network. And Lamont Collins will be joining us. He's founder and CEO of Roots 101 African American Museum here in Louisville. And we'll also be taking your calls later. We want to hear from you. Call us 502-814-TALK, 502-814-8255. Well, who comes to mind when you think of Black history and Kentucky Black history? Who do you admire? Who's been overlooked? Give us a call, 502-814-8255. Well, Dr. Myers, next year you are about to have a book come out on Julia Chin. Tell us a little bit about her and her connection with Richard Mentor Johnson, who would become the ninth Vice President of the United States.
Well, I'm really excited that this book is finally nearing completion. I've been working on it for a very long time. And I think it's really exciting that the book is going to come out when we now have a Black woman as our vice president. I think it's really, the timing is amazing to me because Julia, of course, was, for 23 years, the wife of our ninth vice president, and her story has never been told. And now we are in 2021, we have a Black woman, a Black and South Asian woman who has just been sworn in to the second highest office of the land. And so I think we've at this moment in history, it's really exciting that Julia's story is finally going to be told. And I came across her story about a decade ago. I was doing research, getting ready to teach a U.S. survey class, just a broad survey class, and I came across a footnote on Richard Mentor Johnson. And it mentioned, I'm a 19th century historian and specialist, and I hadn't actually really heard much about him. And they mentioned that he, had this relationship with a woman named Julia Chin. And I thought, I've done all of this research on 18th and 19th century U.S. history. I have a PhD in the area. And how have I never really heard about Johnson or Julia? I'd never heard of Julia. And I went online and started doing a little more research, and there was really nothing about her. And I thought, this is really stunning to me. I had already finished a book on Charleston, South Carolina, and I wanted to know more about Julia, and there was just very little to be found. Julia was enslaved by Richard's parents, Robert and Jemima Suggett Johnson, who were some of the original folks who came out from Virginia to help found the territory of Kentucky. And they were, today we would refer to them as, you know, one percenters. You know, they came out, they were very much amongst the elite. They came out from Virginia. They helped to settle the territory of Kentucky. Robert Johnson, Richard's father, was one of the signers of the original territorial constitution. And he helped survey the land. And they became huge property owners, huge landowners in the state, in what became the state of Kentucky, tens of thousands of acres. And Richard and his family, I mean, they grew up, I mean, this was really frontier land, obviously, but they were enormous land stakeholders, enormous landholders. They, the family grew up with a lot of privilege, obviously white folks. But the boys in the family, the men would grow up to become like their father, you know, holding a lot of different positions in the state, attorney generals, lieutenant governors. They were lawyers. They held a lot of different positions. I mean, Richard himself would be a state legislator. Then he would become a congressman, a senator, and eventually vice president. But even his brothers, they held various different kinds of offices in the state, following in the footsteps of their father. I mean, in fact, his parents would found Great Crossing Baptist Church, which is still in existence today in Kentucky. It was one of the first and most prominent Baptist churches in the state. So this is a very, very wealthy, very powerful, prominent family. And Julia's mother, Henrietta, was enslaved by Robert and Jemima Suggett Johnson. And, of course, because of the way the laws were written, Julia was then, of course, enslaved by Richard's parents as well. She was eventually, along with about 100 other enslaved laborers, transferred to Richard's, you know, she became his property when she was quite young, and eventually became his housekeeper. And when she was, the age difference between them is pretty, pretty stark. He's in his 30s, she's a teenager when they become sexually involved. And he never frees her, but they maintain a relationship for almost a quarter of a century, and they have two children together, two daughters. But what's different from the story that everybody knows about Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, you know, which is a story that everybody in the U.S. talks about, right, the whole Hemings-Jefferson thing, mm-hmm. is that this is a really open relationship. Johnson never marries a white woman. He doesn't date white women. He doesn't have a white family out front, and he doesn't hide Julia and his children out back in the slave quarters. He actually openly acknowledges Julia, and he calls her his wife. They live together. He acknowledges his daughters with her as his own, Imogene and Adeline. He has the daughters educated with a private tutor. And everybody knows that Julia and Imogene and Adeline are his family, his only family. Julia is the mistress of the plantation. She runs everything. She has the keys to the plantation clipped to her belt. She oversees the enslaved laborers who do all the work on the plantation. She has access to all the money, the lines of credit. Richard lives in Washington for 6 months out of every year because he's a full-time career politician. And when he's away, Julia runs everything. I mean, everything. So from the money to the enslaved laborers to, I mean, everything, she's in charge. She's dealing with all the merchants in town. they're doing business with her, and she also oversees these huge parties and fancy balls and soirees that take place on the plantation. She is his wife in every sense of the word. And in fact, there are enslaved laborers who come and, there are oral histories that take place later. And they say that actually Johnson and Chin had a wedding ceremony, and they stood up in front of a preacher and were married, even though that ceremony wasn't recognized by Kentucky law, because Kentucky law wouldn't have honored or, recognized such a marriage between an enslaved person and a white person, or a black and a white person, because they didn't recognize interracial relationships. But supposedly, Richard and Julia had a marriage ceremony performed with a cake and a pink silk dress and the whole, guests and music, violins playing, I Will Be True, which was a famous song of the day. So, I mean, this is not a hidden relationship. It's open. They're living together. They're raising their kids together. They're educating their daughters. And the two daughters grow up. And they marry white men from the local area who know that these are interracial girls, right? The newspapers have a field day with this, right? And so that's what's so amazing about this whole thing. And Johnson keeps getting elected to office, right? He's congressman, senator. It's not hidden. It's not like Thomas Jefferson who lies and hides and, pretends that he doesn't know who Sally and his kids are. I mean, and the daughters are educated. They're given enslaved laborers. They're given money. They're given plantation property. They are wealthy, landed gentry, right, of the era. That's what makes this story so amazing. And what's even more amazing is that what's amazing is that today – like by the middle of the 20th century, even earlier than that, people had completely forgotten about Julia, forgotten about her daughters, forgotten the whole story. And by the time I come along, I'm wondering why it is that I've never heard about Julia Chin or even Richard Mentor Johnson.
Well, we had the same conversation here. I've lived in Kentucky my whole life. And why do you think that is? Why do you think they've kind of faded away?
Well, I actually think it's a really sad but true simple answer. I think the very fact that Richard was so open about his relationship was also why it was erased from the history books. Jefferson, Henry Clay, all of these other politicians had these relationships, but they lied and they hid and so it was. That's why, everybody was okay with it. It's not, most of the white men of that era, a lot of them, let me not say most, let me be clear. Many of the white men of that era were having these relationships, but they also had white women, white marriages, white families, and they lied about their relationships. Henry Clay, who lived just up the road from the Johnsons, had an enslaved mistress. His wife actually caught him in the act of having sex with this woman, and she lost it. And he knew that it was not going to go well for him, and so he sold his black mistress and their children downriver to New Orleans in order to save his marriage. And, nobody ever talked trash about Henry Clay, right? But this is the thing. Johnson was open about his relationship. He actually forced everybody to kind of acknowledge Julia and acknowledge his daughters. And that, I think, was really the problem. When Julia predeceases him, one of his daughters predeceases him, but the other daughter and her aunt, the other daughter who marries Daniel Penn.
Let me stop you there, Dr. Myers. We are up against a break. We'll continue more of this discussion of Julia Chin, and we'll be joined by Dr. Ricky Jones and Lamont Collins as we continue our discussion of Black History and Black History Month on In Conversation on WFPL, Kentucky Public Radio. Welcome back to In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. I'm Rick Howlett. Well, we've been talking with Dr. Amrita Chakrabarty Myers. She's a professor of history and gender studies at Indiana University and has written a book about Julia Chin, a black enslaved woman who was the common law wife of Kentucky politician and plantation owner Richard Mentor Johnson, who would serve one term as vice president of the U.S. There's a lot more to explore here, and we will talk more about the book that's forthcoming. But this segment, we're going to broaden our discussion as well to talk about Black History and Black History Month. And we're going to bring another professor on board. Dr. Ricky Jones is with us. He's the chair of Pan-African Studies at the University of Louisville. He's also an opinion columnist at the Courier Journal and USA Today Network. Dr. Jones, good to have you with us.
Good to be with you, Brother Howlett. How are you doing today?
Doing good. Well, it's been a long time since we've had you on our air. Glad to have you back with us. Also,
good
welcome.
To be with you, brother.
Yes, sir. And also welcome Lamont Collins, founder and CEO of Roots 101 African American Museum in downtown Louisville. Mr. Collins, good to have you with us.
Well, glad to be here. Thank you. I just the opportunity to talk about history. I want to be here. Great.
Yeah, it's going to be a great show. And is it okay if I call you Lamont? You and I don't have our doctorates yet. We're still working on those, so we'll go by
Lamont,
first.
Lamont, yeah, Lamont is fine.
Okay.
Lamont is fine.
We'll go by first names. Thank you. For those still not familiar, let me start with this general question for everybody. For those still not familiar with the origins of Black History Month, Dr. Jones, can you give us a little insight about what it is, why it was created, when did it start, and why is it relevant?
Oh, sure. Black History Month actually started as Negro History Week in 1926. It was spearheaded by Carter G. Woodson, great historian. Anybody who hasn't read it, you really should read Miseducation of the Negro, a number of other things that Carter G. Woodson has written. And what he wrote in 1926 when he started Negro History Week, he said, if a race has no history, it has no worthwhile tradition. It becomes a negligible factor in the thought of the world, and it stands in danger of being exterminated. So what he understood at that point in 1926 was that if you have black people who have no understanding of themselves, then they are necessarily going to be afflicted with an inferiority complex. And if you have white Americans who have no understanding of the contributions of black people to, the forward movement of American history, they're going to be afflicted with a superiority complex, and that's going to be bad for everybody. And we've seen, the consequences of that over the years. So that's how Black History Month actually began. It expanded over the years, and that's where we are now. Unfortunately, it's still not where we need to be with a substantive study of history because things kind of get emptied out in America, but that's what we're dealing with.
And I'll stick with you, Dr. Jones. Of course, this is your all three of yours.
Man, you know to call me Ricky. You've been calling me Ricky for years. So don't
okay.
You call him Lamont and call him Dr.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm a Ricky, too. I dropped the Y a number of years ago, but you can still call me Ricky. Okay, we'll do that. All right. Well, let me stick with you on this. And, of course, this is your vocation. All three of your vocation is sharing black history with your students, among other things. But do you do anything special for Black History Month? Do you change your curricula to reflect what's going on with Black History Month, Ricky?
No, not at all. The fabulous work that Dr. Myers is doing up at Indiana University, the yeoman's work that and I'm going to call him Doctor. We do that in the black community. Dr. Collins is doing over Roots 101. He needs to get over there as soon as they can when this plague passes. This is an ongoing humanization project that we're involved in 12 months of the year, 24 hours a day, 365 days of the year. So nothing changes for us, right? Nothing changes for us. So we want everybody to check us out before February 1st and after February 29th or 28th if we got a leap year. So nothing changes for us at all.
Lamont, let's talk about the museum for a moment. Lamont, you're still operating virtually, right?
Yeah, mostly virtual because of COVID. We're still at 819 West Main Street right beside Fraser. We call it Roots 101 because in higher education, the first class you take is a 101. When Dr. Jones was talking about Carter G. Woodson, we have to remember he has a relationship to Kentucky, which a lot of people forget. He was a student at Berea College, which Berea was one of the main colleges that allowed black people to go to school and get an education during that time. So Carter G. Woodson is a Kentuckian at heart, if you want to say, because he was educated right here in Kentucky. But Roots 101, we're a nonprofit, always seeking dollars to stay afloat. I think we have been nationally talked about across the country. We've got national awards already. We have been open, but due COVID, we had to shut down and do the virtual type of thing. But it's been a beautiful experience up to this point.
And I want to come back to you and talk about all three of you and talk about how the events of 2020 have changed, altered what you do. And let me start with that question for you, Dr. Myers, at Indiana University. Obviously, a lot happened over the past month, given the police killings of Breonna Taylor and George Floyd and many other people across the country. How has that impacted your teaching, how you interact with your students, and how your students interact with you, Dr. Myers?
Well, like Dr. Jones said, I don't change my curriculum in February. The work that I do is, 24/7, 365, as he said, but certainly the pandemic has really changed how I teach, because I've here up at IU, I've been teaching fully online, and that's really shifted how we've been having to work. My students up here have been really very, very invested in the protests, and they've been very active and very engaged. And my classes have been actually more and more students have been interested and invested in taking Black Studies classes, Black History classes. Very, very vocal, and so that's been really gratifying. It's been really exciting. We've been having more and more conversations, open conversations. It hasn't changed necessarily how I teach my courses. One of the things that I'm just very open with them from the jump, like from day one, that, I don't give trigger warnings. I tell them that would be, my whole class would be a trigger warning.
Yeah.
But because we're so close to Louisville in particular, and is being based in Southern Indiana, what happens in Kentucky very much affects this region, right? And so I ground my courses in, we're sandwiched in between Indianapolis and Louisville. And so what happened to Breonna Taylor, what happened to Drayshawn Reed, right? The police killings very much affect this entire region. And so I bring that material into my courses. We talk, a lot of the students actually at IU are drawn from Indianapolis and from Kentucky, from Evansville, from that whole region. And so we bring that material into my courses and we talk about it very directly.
Dr. Ricky Jones, talk about what your classroom has been like in light of the events of the past year.
Well, my classroom is always an intellectual fire pit, brother. You know that. I mean,
yeah.
It's been that way for 25 years here at the University of Louisville. I've still been teaching face-to-face. My classes are much smaller. They've moved them into larger rooms and cut them, more than half. So we got a smaller group of kids who are face-to-face. But, I've been honored to chair one of the oldest Black Studies departments in the country at the University of Louisville for over half my career, coming up on the end of my chairmanship on that. And what we are always trying to tell people in the Department of Pan-African Studies is you cannot have a serious engagement of American history without understanding Black people's place on that landscape, right? And even though they continue to be criminalized, villainized, and dehumanized, what we've contributed to this country is absolutely incalculable. Because more than any other race, black Americans have really been the true believers in what America claims as its ideals. I mean, you tell me, who more than black folk have fought for liberty, freedom, justice, and equality for all? No one. We've really been the conscience of this country. So that's what I'm always trying to push in my classroom. So we've been building global citizens in the Department of Pan-African Studies since 1973, me here since 1996, and that never changes whether we're going through a plague or not. And so the stuff that happened in 2020 just crystallized what's been going on in this country, since folk came here in 1619. So, we keep that in context and keep it going.
And Lamont, I know this has had a direct impact on the museum because the Breonna Taylor Memorial at Jefferson Square Park, it was starting to, they needed to get it out of the weather and out of the elements, and you generously agreed to have it moved to the museum. Tell us about that.
Well, the museum has always been really a headquarters for the movement. I always talk about in African-American history, protest has always been part of progress. So it was only a natural fit for Route 101 to be involved. And a lot of young people came to us to get involved because we do tell the story 365 days a year. And when I talk to young people, I call it our house. because they can come to a place that they know that they're descendants of kings and queens that were enslaved in America. So the mindset of Route 101 had just connected naturally and spiritually with the protest, because that's the story we're telling. We're telling about the journey. We're doing it in a Drake type of way. We started from the bottom and we're here. So, you know, that's the story. You like that, Ricky? You're going to steal that one, right?
I love that.
but that's what we do. So because we do it, young people gravitate to us now. Will Breonna Taylor's memorial stay as it is or how it will be? That depends on Breonna Taylor's family. What I did was just give them an open door to, you know, historically, when we buried our ancestors in Africa, we buried them near the river. Route 101 sits right beside the Ohio River, which we call the River Jordan. So her spirit will always flow down the Ohio River as long as the memorial's there. But we know there's other museums with big dollars that will probably take what we have away. But we're still going to continue to tell the story no matter what happens.
And Dr. Ricky Jones, what do you think about what's being taught to the young people in the schools in terms of Black history? I've heard some complain that too many history classes don't seem to get past, you know, slavery and Dr. King and what it teaches about Black history. Do you think that's the case, or is it getting better? Are they going deeper as you do in your classes?
Look, what's being taught to our children about Black people and then ostensibly the history of America's, you know, K-12 and at the college and university level is absolutely horrible. Let me slow that down, because I cannot overemphasize it. It is absolutely horrible.
The education 100%
right. Co-sign again.
Failure where our children are concerned is reprehensible. It is inhumane. It's damaging. And it is something we need to address, because if we don't address the educational shortcomings that we have right now, then we're not going to get to where we need to be. But when you talk about what's being taught right now, we like Lamont said about Drake, we really got to start from the bottom, because you can't teach what you don't know. And the majority of teachers that we have in the K-12 system and the majority of professors that we have in higher education, they came through the American education system and they weren't taught anything about Black people. So how the hell can they legitimately teach our students anything about Black people? So everybody has got to absolutely retool right now. They haven't done it to date because it simply hasn't been important to them. But if America is going to become a serious 21st century cosmopolitan humane country, it's something they need to address and address seriously and not just play with it.
And Dr. Myers, do you agree? I'll give you a chance.
Yes. This is something that I mean, on the very first day of my U.S. survey, general U.S. survey class, I tell my students that African-American history is first and foremost American history, and that you cannot understand American history at all if you do not understand African-American history, and that Black history must be integrated into the curriculum of every single class, from kindergarten on upwards. And that is the disservice that we are doing to our students. And every semester, I have students in every class that I teach who come up to me of every background, every ethnicity, every race, including Black students. And they are enraged, they are angry, they are literally on the verge of tears, and they are like, why have I had to, why am I only now learning this history? Yeah. Why am I 19, 20, 21 years old and only now learning the truth? And they are furious with their teachers, with their parents, with this country for not having educated them. Because without knowing the full story, they are not equipped to be fully, you know, engaged and able to actually make changes to the structural inequities that we are facing right now.
Amen
on that one.
So, Dr. Myers, just to follow up, how do you go about making changes to this, to the early curriculum, and getting better information out to young people? Is it through the legislative process?
It's multi-pronged. And first and foremost, people think that all you need to do is show up once every 4 years and cast your ballot. Shame on you if that's what you think, that that's all you need to do. We need people who got to start from the ground up. I have friends here in Monroe County who have started to like info. I mean, they are running. They have run and won positions on the school board. Number one, that's really, really important. People need to think local. It's not just about casting your ballot for the presidency, although let's be clear, that was very important this time around, as we understand. You got to look at your local school boards. We have school boards all across this country that are rewriting curriculum and passing legislation so that textbooks are wiping out Native American history, African American history. They're saying, oh, you don't have to teach slavery. You don't have to teach Native American genocide. They're making it so that so that the history that's being taught to our kids is whitewashed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there's a lot of different things that we got to be doing to make sure that get on those school boards. Make sure that the textbook curriculum isn't being rewritten. It's a multi-pronged effort that we have to do, because by the time they get to my classes and Dr. Jones's classes, it's sometimes too late.
Yeah, it's a rescue project then.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, I grew up, I'm a white male in his 50s, upper 50s. I grew up, and the thing that had the biggest impact on me growing up in school was when they put us all on the bus and we came to downtown Louisville from Bardstown and saw the movie Sounder, because I got a firsthand look about what life was like for black people during that period of time that it set in. And that really resonated with me more than anything they taught out of a book.
Mm. Well, you know, at the museum, I always... whoever comes in the museum holds the slave chains. I have some of the oldest set of slave chains in the country. And one set I have everyone hold over 400 years from Ghana. And the reason I have everybody hold them, because slavery is the foundation of America. So we have to start with that story. That is a story that we still have injustices in our system from the medical profession, from attorneys, from slave laws. It all started with chains. Our system of management started with slavery. So we have to tell that story and work our way through. And whether it makes people uncomfortable or comfortable, we have to do it. And now that I'm sitting on many boards with national institutions, as far as museums have been the concrete bed of white supremacy. So I have to attack that story and tell the true story. That we were the bulldozer before bulldozers, the jackhammers before jackhammers, and the engineers before engineering degrees. We built America, and America has to understand black history is American history, and that's what we do at Roots 101.
We are
museums are so critical. Museums are absolutely critical, because so many people who will never come into our classrooms will actually get their history from museum and historic site spaces. And if we don't decolonize those spaces, people are going to be wandering around with all kinds of nonsensical ideas about black people, Latinx people, and indigenous people. We've just had a major scandal at the Indianapolis Museum of Art that just broke this past week. And the director has just resigned and stepped down as a result of that. So the work that you're doing with your museum is absolutely critical to educate people who will never take a class.
We're up against a break. We're going to come back and talk much more. We're talking about Black History and Black History Month with University of Louisville Pan-African Studies Chair Dr. Ricky Jones, Lamont Collins, founder and CEO of Roots 101 African-American Museum, and Indiana University Professor Dr. Amrita Chakrabarty-Myers. Much more coming up after a break. This is In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio.
Support for LPM Podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
Welcome back to In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. I'm Rick Howlett, and we're having a lively discussion about Black History and Black History Month with University of Louisville Pan-African Studies Chair Dr. Ricky Jones, Lamont Collins, who is founder and CEO of Roots 101 African American Museum here in downtown Louisville, and Indiana University Professor of History and Gender Studies, Dr. Amrita Chakrabarty-Myers, is with us as well. We want to hear from you, too. If you have a question or comment for us, call us at 502-814-TALK, 502-814-8255. You can send us a tweet. WFPL News is our handle, and we're also on Facebook. Dr. Myers has a book coming out soon, currently titled Remembering Julia, A Tale of Sex, Race, Power, and Place, and it chronicles the decades-long relationship of Julia Chen, an enslaved woman of color, and Congressman, Senator, and one-term Vice President Richard Mentor Johnson. A white man, the couple lived together in rural Kentucky during the 1810s, 20s, and 30s. And when's your book coming out again, Dr. Myers?
It'll be out next year, and we've actually retitled it. The title is now The Vice President's Black Wife.
Oh, okay. We'll make a note of that. And we were talking about it earlier in the show, but I want to come back to it. Are there any artifacts, markers, buildings, or anything that commemorating Julia Chen or her life in that part of Kentucky?
No, there are not. The farm, Blue Spring Farm, it is no longer in the hands of the family. Unfortunately, there was a Native American boarding school that was run on the plantation back in the day called Choctaw Academy. There's one remaining building from the academy that still is on the property. And it was a few years ago, thanks to the work of some local folks who were invested in making sure that that building didn't fall into the ground. It's been declared a National Historic Site. But that's, you know, because it was a Native American boarding school. And so thankfully, that's been declared a National Historic Site, but that doesn't have anything to do with Julia specifically. There isn't a marker anywhere, you know, noting that this was the farm of a vice president, that this was, and the plantation house itself no longer exists. Like everything has sort of disappeared. So the big house, quote unquote, is no longer there. There's no marker noting that it was Richard's home, that Julia lived there, nothing at all. And that's, we don't actually even know where Julia Chen herself, where her grave site is. And that's one of the things I talk about in my book, that she's literally been erased. And I think it's, like I said, it's because of the shame, right? That he was open about the relationship. His brothers and white family members were embarrassed about this. And so we've literally, you know, no biography was written about him since 1932. And I've said, like, literally in my book, I write about the fact that we've lost the vice president's wife. We don't even know where her remains are, or where she's buried. And this would have never happened if she was a white woman and they had what, you know, a quote unquote traditional relationship. But the shame of interracial sex, of slavery, erased her from the books. And we're only just now beginning to recover her life and her story. And one of the things that I'm hoping to do, and I've been trying to do, is work with the University of Kentucky, because they have ground-penetrating sonar equipment, and try to find where her remains are, because most likely she would have been buried on Blue Spring property, which is what people did back in the day. And if we can find her grave site, I'd like to have a marker put up to honor her.
And I know when we had to stop for the break earlier in the program, you were talking about she passed away before her husband, right?
Correct. She died. There was a major cholera epidemic in Kentucky in 1833, and she passed away during that epidemic. She was actually, she had medical training, and she was a very, very good, from all the primary sources I was able to uncover, she was actually a very good physician, and she went to work trying to save people from the cholera epidemic that broke out in the area, and she saved a lot of people's lives before she herself contracted cholera and then died.
You're listening to In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL. We're talking about Black History and Black History Month with Indiana University professor Dr. Amrita Chakrabarty Myers. Lamont Collins is with us. He's founder and CEO of Roots 101 African American Museum here in Louisville. And also on the phone with us is University of Louisville Pan-African Studies Chair Dr. Ricky Jones. And Ricky, I want to come back to you with another question. What do you think people 20, 40, 50, 100 years from now will view in terms of history, the events of the last year, the Black Lives Matter movement and the protests that we saw here in Louisville and around the country?
They'll simply place them into context of the historical landscape. You know, that's what they'll do. They'll place them into context of the Stono Secret Rebellion, you know, in the 1700s, of the New York insurrection in 1741. They'll place him into context of Gabriel Prosser, Denmark Vesey, Nat Turner, John Brown. You know, that's what they'll do. So we've always seen resistance movements to white supremacy. And I have to be clear on what this is. Everything that we're talking about, just like you can't understand America without understanding black people's place in America, you can't understand America without a rigorous engagement of white supremacy either, because that's really what all this runs back to. And it's not some cartoonish understanding, Brother Rick, of, you know, white supremacists just being, you know, members of the Ku Klux Klan running around burning crosses in people's yards at night, or, you know, the Proud Boys or white supremacists running around in Charlottesville, Virginia, screaming Jews will not replace us. What white supremacy at its core is really about is a good percentage of white people in this country, from school boards to universities to companies to everyday people on the street, thinking that white Americans are the group that have the ultimate right to think, know, and decide on everything that is key in this country, to think, know, and decide. And if you push back against that, you know, they can get pretty upset with you, and there can be consequences in everything from curriculum, you know, to political disenfranchisement, to everything. So I think that's how people, when they get serious about these studies and contextualize the history of these movements, will look at what went on in 2020, you know, because it's still going on in 2021. People just aren't paying as much attention to it. They'll put it in its proper context. It's a fight against white supremacy.
What are your thoughts on that, Dr. Myers?
Well, I think that Dr. Jones is absolutely right. I think that the thing that we have to be concerned about right now is making sure that this is not that this was not and is not just a moment, but that it becomes a sustained movement to, you know, become something larger than it is. I mean, I know that when the protests started last year, many of us were like, is this going to simply become a one day, a one week sort of a thing, or is this going to become something larger? Protests are not and are never simply and should never just be an end in and of themselves, but right, that they have to lead to something larger. And we, you know, what we've had happening, right, that these protests, it's COVID, it's the protests, it's the larger political moment that we find ourselves in. And I do think that this is actually a different different moment. And I do think that we need that we've already started to see larger changes in cities like Los Angeles, in cities like Minneapolis, where you're beginning to see shifts in terms of budgetary changes, financial restructuring, as police departments begin to like rethink how they're structured, as school boards and educational systems begin to rethink how they're structured. And this is what we need to really begin to, you know, we need to move beyond just the moment and the protests and begin to actually use this opportunity to begin to like make larger structural changes. That's what's going to actually shift how people look at this moment 40 or 50 or 100 years from now. But ultimately, I agree with Dr. Jones that it is part of the longer, long-standing, centuries-long battle that we've been having against white supremacy in this country.
Lamont, can you talk a little bit about the impact that we talked about earlier? The Breonna Taylor Memorial was moved to the museum, but just the general impact, has been more interest and more interest in perhaps people donating or taking part in the museum over the past year in light of what's happened?
Yeah, I think we've been able to tap in the heart of people. We haven't been able to tap into the pocketbooks of corporations. But we have been able to tap in the heart of people. We have people, white allies, that send me information or pictures that were sitting in their house, and they felt like it didn't belong there. It belonged in a house that was telling the story of the African-American journey. So I've seen that. I think Dr. Jones mentioned Carter Woodson's book, Miseducation of the Negro. And what I've found out in Route 101 is my opportunity is to re-educate white America, re-educate the things that they find as the truth, and breaking those truths down and being able to discuss those truths and go into a healing moment and a healing space that this museum is able to do. That's what makes the museum so unique, is that we can sit and talk and discuss the truth of history and walk away better than what we came in. So what I've seen is a different heart, like I said, I haven't seen the financial contributions to make this work, but I do find people wanting to find more information about how they can become better ancestors. We have a motto at the museum that I say, becoming a better ancestor. And my challenge is for everyone, white, black, purple, blue, whatever, is that if we become better citizens and better people, then America can get better. And that's how we're treating it. We're treating the wound from a perspective of education and compassion, and maybe we can break the mold of supremacy in the process. And that's what I see from what the Breonna Taylor Memorial, is that we're going in a different time because we won't have the Leave It to Beaver family that we have now. Families have changed. And when they change, sometimes they listen to people they love more than people on the outside. So if I can educate people they love, then I have an opportunity to change some families that will not talk, will not walk, or even think about doing anything for the quality of other people.
We have a call at 502-814-TALK. Let's go to Lexington, Kentucky, and Ryan. Hello, Ryan. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure.
I just had a quick question. I'm a high school teacher in Central Kentucky. I teach social studies, and I was wanting to ask one of the guests, in particular, what are the types of questions you ask specifically with your white students in mind about black history and race in particular? What are the questions that you found help really open your students up to be more receptive to learning?
Well, we'll ask everybody about that. We'll start with you, Ricky Jones. Go ahead.
I don't ask any questions of my white students that are different than questions I ask of my black students or materials that I expose them to. I think that all of these students are thirsty. You know, I think this generation of students, even though young folk are, you know, criticized a lot, I think they approach race in a different way than we, you know, Gen Xers have, and certainly different than boomers. So I think these people, these kids are thirsty for information, thirsty for knowledge, thirsty for truth. I would give you some advice. If you're in a place where you have a university with a black studies department or program, hook up with those professors and try to bring their help, their curricula into your classroom, because we've seen all kinds of bureaucratic stonewalling from school systems, including here in Louisville, where they don't bring in serious curriculum changes. So you're going to have to do that as an individual right now. Partner with some people who really know what they're doing about black history, politics, social structures, all of these things, and go from there.
Dr. Myers, thoughts on that?
Yeah, I actually was just thinking to myself that there's a really, really great set of scholars at the University of Kentucky in Black Studies and History: Vanessa Holden, Anastasia Kerwood, Melissa Stein, and others who we could, I mean, very easily put you in touch with. They've been, Derek White and others are there now. They've been hiring. They have a wonderful group of scholars who are there. If you're interested, you know, we can easily put you in touch with them.
Sure.
I teach history at a predominantly white institution, and I don't really sort of think about the fact that my students are white in that sense, like Dr. Jones said. And I've also found that my students are very, very passionate about learning this material. And what I actually found really, really sort of poignant actually over the last several years is that many of them have been very open about the fact that their commitment to standing with BLM and civil rights has actually caused a break and a breach in their own households and in their own families, that there's a generational divide that's really happening across the country, that their grandparents, their families are actually kicking them out or disowning them for standing with the cause of racial justice. And so I actually think that it really behooves us to sort of be really sensitive and aware of that fact, that we have a lot of, like Dr. Jones said, that this generation is actually yearning for this material, and that they're yearning to learn and understand, but that they're actually going through a lot of stress and trauma actually at home, because their families are not on board with what they are. right? That they are actually wanting to actually join the movement, and that they're facing a lot of stress about this and a lot of grief at home about it.
I agree.
Ryan, has it been a challenge for you to get students, white students, to talk about Black history and especially the events of the past year or so?
I think so. I teach mostly sophomores and juniors, and I teach history and sociology at the high school level. And, I teach right outside of Lexington, and I think it's not so much that students don't want to talk about race and Black history. It's they do not have the social tools of how to talk about race in a more comfortable way. And that's honestly the thing that I found most challenging. Being a white teacher, teaching to predominantly white students, there's almost kind of we've been told not to talk about this. And I found that good questions tend to open students up more, but that's still just an ongoing struggle that I have with my students.
Here's a question. Ask them why they've been told not to talk about it. And ask yourself why you've been taught not to talk about it. That's a good jump off point.
Yeah.
Mm. Great.
That's a good one, yeah.
I know at Roots, we see so many young white kids come in because they want that relationship and want that understanding of what history really is. And a lot of the Black Lives Matter group that I deal with, the first thing I tell them historically is that Black lives have always mattered. We've always had organizations that said it mattered, NAACP, Urban League, SNCC, you go on. We always knew our lives matter. It's just a different time and a different space. But we always understood that our lives matter and excellence matters. So really the Black Lives Movement is nothing new to the Black community. What's changed is that we have more of the white community come out to support it as we move forward, and we never saw that in the past like we see now. We've never seen so many white kids in the streets every day and fighting for freedom and fighting for injustice. And I think because of that, like the doctor said, that some families are breaking apart, but some families are coming together. So, it's the best of times and worst of times. But it's a beautiful time to change America.
I'll let that be the last word. That's a very appropriate last word. Ryan, thanks for your call. We are out of time, and thanks to all of our guests, Dr. Ricky Jones, Lamont Collins, and Dr. Amrita Chakrabarty-Myers. Great conversation. Good to have you with us. We'll do it again.
No doubt. Good to hear you. Good to talk to you, Brother Rick.
You too. Take care. Thanks to our In Conversation production team, Michelle Tyrene Johnson, Laura Ellis, Brad Yost, Russell Wells, and Bill Burton. Our theme was composed by Kojin Toshiro. If you missed any of today's show or want to listen to previous programs, follow us wherever you get your podcast or visit WFPL.org. And if you have show suggestions, comments, or questions, other thoughts, email us at inconversation@WFPL.org. I'm Rick Howlett. Thanks for listening.